This is Crossroads, the Get Religion podcast.
The press machine is already gearing up for what will prove to be at least part of one of the biggest religion stories in 2019. Next month's Vatican Summit on clergy sexual abuse. I actually read a story just this morning in anticipation of that. And another story that may be related, and that is the resignation of the director of the Vatican's press office. Are those two stories related? Greetings and welcome to Crossroads with Terry Mattingly. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. Terry Mattingly is Senior Fellow for Media and Religion at the King's College in New York City. He's author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate and the book Pop Goes Religion, and he's founder and editor of Get Religion. Terry, welcome back.
Glad to be here.
So are the two stories related, the resignation of Greg Burke and also of his assistant there, Paloma Oviero, also they resigned at the same time, and the upcoming summit?
There's really no way to know the answer to that, yet the assumption of almost every single thing I've read online about the two events does connect them. And the common thesis, well, let me give you two statements of it. One is by our mutual friend, Rod Dreher, who tweeted out the other day, I think the resignation is less because Burke is American and more that he's a media professional whose background is in reporting, not PR. Burke might have feared becoming the kind of person that real journalists hate. In other words, if you were handed one of the biggest events in the world and a primary part of your job was preventing the coverage of it, wouldn't that put you in an awkward position? That's kind of thesis number one. The second is from a must-read article at Commonweal that I put out earlier today. I put up an aggregation pointing people toward it. It's a piece by one of their regular contributors named Paul Moses. And toward the end of it, he kind of looks at this through the lens that everybody's going to want to use because, you know, we're into labels and things have to be liberals versus conservatives, black hats versus white hats. He says that the sudden departures of these two men, quote, are being dissected through the usual anti-Francis ideological monocle used to view Vatican developments, especially since Burke's role as a numerary member of Opus Dei gives him cred as a Catholic conservative. But I would look at it through a different lens. As an American, Burke was an outsider in an insider's job, fluent in Italian, but not necessarily in the level of nuance employed in Vatican speak. The Vatican culture of caution and cover-up did not suit him. When you get to the end of that, he adds some other color there, but basically agrees with the same point that Rod Dreher made, which is he didn't want to be wearing the PR man's suit at this upcoming convention. Maybe he knew how it was going to come out. I'm sure that's a question that he could not afford to answer. Maybe he knew who the people running the event would really be, and he knew he couldn't cooperate with them. That would be another reality. As we, you know, things are not always completely in the control of the Pope, as we could see by what we know now about a lot of things that happened in the era of St. John Paul II, and to a lesser extent in the age of Benedict. If we've learned anything from the last year, it's the importance of some of the networks of connected bishops, cardinals, archbishops, seminary leaders, etc., and kind of how they have to work together to protect their interests. We live in a sinful, fallen world, and anyone who's active in a church is well aware of that.
What does the media do maybe I'm oversimplifying, but it seems they might find themselves between a rock and a hard place, because this isn't good press for anybody, including Francis. But speaking of black and white hats, the media generally wants to put the white one, figuratively and literally, on Francis's head. But he is synonymous in some ways with the Vatican, at least past popes may have been.
Yeah, I really see a kind of interesting trend here right now, where the irony is that the story you know is safer than the story you don't know from the perspective of leaders of the church at this point. And the story they know and the story that everyone's talking about and we see the headlines is framed consistently as the problem of priests abusing children. And that wording is ubiquitous. It's everywhere. That's why a couple of months ago, I sat down, because I had all kinds of people asking me, and I think we've discussed this on the air one other time in an earlier broadcast and podcast. I finally sat down and wrote out what I think the big issues are in this story. So maybe I could repeat those for you right now.
Sure.
And I'd stress that I wrote these three after reviewing material from people I have interviewed through the years, both on the Catholic left, as in the late Richard Sipe, one of the key activists featured in his voice shows up several places in the famous, justifiably famous, in my opinion, movie Spotlight, and also a Catholic academic, Father Donald Cousins, the author of a book on the future of the priesthood that set everybody abuzz way over a decade ago, with his very candid talk about the role of homosexuality in Roman Catholic academic and ecclesiastical networks. And then a conservative, an investigator and academic named Leon Podels. One of my principles as a journalist when covering a story as complex and nuanced as this one, and I would stress again, a story in which there are plenty of buried skeletons, closets, buried body, mix the metaphors however you want it. There's a lot of bad stuff in hiding on both the Catholic left and the right. So anyway, looking back through my material through the years with Sipe, Cousins, and Podels, I came up with the following three. This is in order of importance. Number one, the key to the scandal is secrecy, violated celibacy vows, and potential blackmail. Lots of Catholic leaders, left and right, gay and straight, have sexual skeletons in their closets, often involving sex with consenting adults. These weaknesses, past and or present, create a climate of secrecy in which it's hard to crack down on crimes linked to child abuse. So in other words, the child abuse scandal and the hiding of the priest involved in it, that's often related to the fact that other people are not in a position to judge because they know their own secrets can be yanked out, even if those secrets involve consensual sex outside of their vows. Okay, number two, classic pedophiles tend to strike children of both genders. However, in terms of raw statistics, most child abuse cases linked to the Catholic clergy are not true cases of pedophilia, but are examples of ephebophilia, intense sexual interest in post-pubescent teens or those on the doorway of the teen years. The overwhelming majority of these clergy cases are adult males with young males. How often in this coverage have you seen it mentioned that a young boy is first seduced, courted, wooed, set up right at the age of about 11 or 12, and then is sexually abused on into his pubescent teen years? So then point number three, one of the biggest secrets hiding in the bitter fog from all of these facts is the existence of powerful networks of sexually active gay priests with many powerful predators. McCarrick, a former Cardinal Ted McCarrick, is a classic example. Based at seminaries and in ecclesiastical offices, thus these men have extraordinary power in shaping the lives of future priests. Now, if you accept my premises there with those three points, you could see that what the public should expect to see out of this big event is lots and lots of talk about preventing child abuse. Child abuse is the story we know, and that, in a bizarre way, makes it the safe story.
Hmm.
Do you see that?
That's crazy.
But it's safer than the other stories, which actually concern the protection of the priests and bishops who hid them. And it's that protection that then gets you back to the issue that I tried to point out right up front, which is that the secret of this whole thing is secrecy. It's like a matryoshka doll in Russia, where you pull the layers off and you go deeper into the scandal and deeper into the scandal and deeper into the scandal. And at the inside is the central issue of secrecy and a wide variety of violated vows and, like I said, potential blackmail. It's hard to crack down on a crime or a sin if there are people you know can pull your own out into public.
Terry, tell me if I'm misreading you or saying too much. It sounds like what you're saying is that the Vatican will be happy to talk about preventing child sexual abuse. And, you know, with the cameras rolling, they'll be happy to do that. Maybe even a few mea culpas, which have been very, very rare, if in evidence at all. As long as they don't have to talk about something far more fundamental to the very structure of the organization at this point, which is its penchant, its addiction to secrecy on all fronts.
On a variety of sexual fronts. I'm not sure I would use the word happy. There's a saying in Washington that when presented with a problem, you hang a lantern on it. You want to be the person who provides the sound bites and the story angles that must be covered so that you get to define the problem. Well, that's precisely what I'm saying here. I'm expecting potentially even some amazing visuals to come out of the conference. I mean, cardinals on their faces in penitence. I mean, I'm just thinking out loud here. Could you imagine the media coverage of a moment of a row of victims sitting in chairs and Pope Francis and several cardinals going before them one at a time and prostrating themselves and asking for their forgiveness? You think that'd make the evening news?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. But at the same time, as valid as that might be, as valid as litanies of repentance would be, and I'm all for that in this case, do you see how all of that media attention on this extremely big spectacle would be great for deflecting the fact that they still haven't approved a policy on how to discipline bishops, archbishops, and cardinals, which seem to be at the heart of the recent showdown between some key American leaders and the Vatican in terms of whether the U.S. bishops were going to create a policy in which lay people were involved in hearing materials related to the discipline of bishops. And, you know, that was yanked off the table, and that's supposed to come up now in a global context at this upcoming super summit. Yet at the same time, it also prevented it from happening. It would have put Rome in a bad position if the U.S. bishops were suddenly on the record as saying the same kind of laity-centered or cooperative panels that have outed a lot of the abusing priests, that same kind of system should be applied to the prelates and the shepherds at the top of the hierarchy. Now, there is a sincere problem here, and that is that under Catholic canon law, who gets to discipline bishops? Rome alone. Which means allowing lay people into that process cuts some of Rome's ability to deal directly with bishops, archbishops, and cardinals, and kind of make a decision about which ones Rome wants to bring down and discipline or throw out, and which ones maybe they don't. That's really kind of black ops, dark arts to some degree, but that's what people are talking about here. I summed all of this up in a piece that I wrote for Get Religion by asking what I've already heard from several people saying, gosh, what a nasty little question. What did you mean by it? You know, what would Jesus do, the wristbands and all that? Going into this meeting and looking at the Burke situation, the press office situation, I suggested that reporters simply ask the following questions. If this man were still in a position of power, if he was still cardinal in Washington, D.C., if he was involved in the planning for this event, what would Ted McCarrick do? In other words, if you get in the TARDIS, if you get in the Doctor Who machine and go back 15 years, 10 years, back to the age when Uncle Ted is being followed around by reporters and is in a position to drive the press coverage of a major event, what would Ted McCarrick do in that circumstance? Well, here you go. Here's what he would do based on what he did back then. One, he would strongly back in words whatever Rome and the Pope said. He would enthusiastically support whatever came out of Rome. Even in his case, if that was a conservative such as St. Pope John Paul II and or Benedict, he would publicly stand up at the microphones and affirm it and affirm it and affirm it with his words. Then he would, in his actions, do everything to protect his friends and to protect the networks that are at the heart of his power and his clout. And thus, he would encourage the press to follow the old story and not ask any questions about the new ones. In other words, go with what's in front of you. Don't ask questions about the machinery behind it, because the machinery behind it is bishops, archbishops, and cardinals. What would Ted McCarrick do? There are worse questions that could drive coverage in the next 2 to 3 months.
Are you insinuating that the current people, McCarrick is, where is he, holed away someplace in Missouri, if I'm not mistaken?
Kansas. He's in western Kansas. And you know the old saying, diamonds are forever. Diamonds are not forever. Kansas is forever. And he's at a cathedral in the middle of and monastery in the middle of West Kansas. I've driven right past it on an interstate. You can see it coming, the Cathedral of the Plains. You can see it coming from like 30, 40 miles away.
Are you insinuating that what the end result of this summit next month will be, it will be as though Cardinal McCarrick were still running things?
Well, I'm saying, quite bluntly, that many of the people closest to McCarrick during his years of greatest power, several of them are in charge of the summit and are in charge of events happening right now. In other words, the structures, I mean, if you go back to the stories about McCarrick and you look at the names in Rome and in very, very important cathedral thrones here in America, McCarrick 2.0, to some degree, in terms of protection of the network, is still very much with us.
What should media consumers want to hear and even demand to hear from the media about the upcoming summit?
Well, first of all, they shouldn't expect much, for the simple reason that when you're dealing at the international level, Rome and the Vatican is not subject to subpoenas or anything. There's nothing you can do to force Rome to even, like say, give out the papers that Archbishop Vigano famously would say would prove his case. You can't subpoena the embassy in D.C. You can't roll up in front of the Vatican and say, come out, come out. But several questions. You're going to see over and over about the scandal with children. I would ask for more content on the ages of the people involved in the actual abuse. The word that I always look for in a story about the current controversy, besides looking for the name of McCarrick, if McCarrick is somehow still mentioned, or has McCarrick been forgotten and sent off to western Kansas, where he could probably die in a couple of months or so. Not because he was offed or something, but because he's elderly. The seminaries continue to be a crucial question. And when you see, the most spectacular sins of McCarrick were linked to very, very Catholic content situations. Here's a cardinal or a bishop abusing seminarians whose careers are completely in his hands. Now, here in just the last couple of days, we finally have seen formalized what people have talked about for a long time, which was that McCarrick appears to have been abused young men in confession, in the acts of confession. That's got to be a canonical law violation, not to mention secular law. That's got to break every conceivable sacramental law in the book, to actively sexually abuse a young man in confession. So I would ask about seminaries. I would continue to ask about the networking surrounding McCarrick. In other words, when we looked at the details of the McCarrick scandal, who were the names most frequently connected and associated with McCarrick? The questions that I've heard asked is on three levels that go back for decades. Who brought McCarrick to power? Who shared power with McCarrick? And who did McCarrick then bring to power? Does that make sense? It's like three generations. So look for the names and ask lots of questions about that. I would then stress again, never forget that this is not strictly an issue of the Catholic left or the Catholic right. Everybody needs to be asked a bunch of tough questions and try to get the "we love Francis, we love the progressives, we love what's good for the sexual revolution," in our opinion, as progressive Americans or journalists or whatever. We want to see what we want to see. Try to forget that and ask a lot of hard questions to conservatives and Catholic liberals alike.
Terry Mattingly is Senior Fellow for Media and Religion at the King's College in New York City. He's author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate and the book Pop Goes Religion. He's also founder and editor of Get Religion. Terry, thank you so much for your time.
Glad to be here.
I'm Todd Wilkin. I'll talk with you next week. Thanks for listening to Crossroads with Terry Mattingly.
Crossroads is a joint production of GetReligion.org and Issues Etc.